This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
This is John Middlecoff from 3 and Out with John Middlecoff. Superchargers, headlights, and more. With over 122 million parts, eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Stay on your A-game with all the parts you need at the prices you want. It's easy to bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And we don't just mean the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out, the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
The Volume.
Oh my God, how could he do that?
Are you on drugs? What?
Charles Darwin.
The Nerds is where it's at.
Welcome everybody back into Nerd Sesh. As always, I'm Carson Greber, and alongside me is Logan Camden, and it is officially the most wonderful time of the year because we are into postseason basketball. So today, we are going to be previewing all of the play-in games. We are also going to give our predictions for 2 first-round series as we just continue to work our way through all the first-round series throughout this week. But we're going to start, Logan, with that 7-8 matchup out west. Lakers-Pelicans, which of course we just saw on the last day of the regular season for the Lakers to lock up that 8 seed and to push the Pelicans into the play-in and ultimately keep the Suns out of it. So what's the first key that stands out to you when you're looking at this rematch?
Well, the first thing I want to address is something that's been doing the rounds on social media. I know you tweeted it facetiously yesterday, and then I believe Mike Greenberg on GetUp actually took the take and said the Lakers should lose intentionally. Here's something I just want to say fundamentally about all sports. I don't know if you guys believe in, like, cosmic entities or deities or, you know, other external forces, real or not. I believe there are basketball gods, and I believe that if the Los Angeles Lakers lost intentionally, they would just be giving a big fat, you know, double bird to the basketball gods. I think if you do that in any sport, I think you are, like, disrespecting and desecrating the game a little bit. And if they do that, it's just not a good look, and I think you're, you know, starting out with a bad omen. And two, I just think it's a dumb idea. Like,
yeah.
If you do that, you're putting yourself in a back-against-the-wall scenario where you then could potentially just miss out on the playoffs completely. So I think,
absolutely,
first and foremost, you go in against New Orleans, you handle business like you did the other night, and you get the thing done with, and then you go play Denver. I mean, it's almost inevitable at this point. Like, if you are serious championship contenders and you are going to go and win the title, and that is the goal of this Lakers roster, and I believe they're a real championship contender. I wouldn't pick them to beat Denver. But if they're going to go win the championship, they're going to have to go handle business against Denver regardless. So you either get it out now or you get it out later. In my opinion, I just say don't play with your food, man. Go in there, handle business against New Orleans, and go ahead and, you know, take the tough battle.
Yeah, there's just too much variance in any one basketball game to risk deliberately putting your season on the line in that single game format, especially if you're up against Steph Curry, who just single-handedly can go as nuclear as anybody in the sport, or Even the Kings, who I would have a good deal of confidence in the Lakers beating, but specifically has been a very tough matchup for them. I do think some of those dynamics change without Malik Monk, but the Fox-Sabonis matchup alone. And at the end of the day, these are quality basketball teams, and you don't want to put yourself in a situation where it's, oh, cool, we went 5 of 30 from deep, and you guys went 18 of 35, and like that's the game right there. That just happens too often in these single-game environments. But I did tweet about that because, Logan, if there was a dream scenario for the Lakers, like if they could know, hey, we can lock up either the 7 or the 8 seed, of course they would rather lock up the 8 seed, because then you draw OKC, really good basketball team, but an awesome matchup for the Lakers. They owned the regular season series, and they're just so huge, so physical against this young, slight, inexperienced team. They have two superstars. That's a really bad matchup for OKC. And then second round, if you draw the Mavs or the Clippers, like those are really good basketball teams, but the Lakers would have a very real chance against either one of them. Whereas the Nuggets are not only just clearly the best team out West, they have particularly had the Lakers number over and over again over these last couple years. So I did tweet about that. I was mostly joking. I didn't expect it to then be like the hot take on the sports morning shows the next day. Can't really say I'm surprised, but you just can't mess with the basketball gods like that. But more so, you cannot mess with the legitimate probability of just missing the playoffs outright because you got cute and you let it come down to one game where anything can happen.
100%, man. I completely agree. And on that, I mean, we did just see both of these teams play. And I think, I don't know, man. The Lakers engaged are just a scary basketball team.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I know the Pelicans have their own flaws. Like, you know, this is a good defensive basketball team. They win games on the back of athleticism, physicality, defense, and then offensively. I did think Brandon Ingram looked really good in his return for stretches there. Zion's going to have to be more impactful in an individual game format. But the Lakers just, against, you know, when their backs are against the wall, when they have needed games and have been, like, completely locked, this just looks like a different team, especially when LeBron can exert this level of control over a basketball game. I mean, from tip-off to the end of the game, it was LeBron saying, all right, man, I'm going to dissect you. I am going to get into the teeth of the defense. I'm going to collapse everybody. I'm going to get all the attention on me, and I'm going to find my guys. I mean, he dominated that basketball game, 28, 17, and 11. And that's kind of a big theme, I think, for these playoffs, not just these individual games, but the playoffs as a whole. I wonder, Carson, and I know you said this to me a couple of weeks ago, I do wonder if I put LeBron too low on my top 10 players, man. I wonder if I just undervalued his just complete mastery in control of the game. Like, again, 28, 17, and 11, that makes no sense at this age of his career, but he still just exerts this control over the game. And when LeBron wants to flip that switch, I mean, I just think the Lakers are one of the best teams in basketball. When LeBron wants to control a basketball game like this, I still think he can. And a number somebody put out on Twitter, Carson, he's the first player in NBA history to shoot 72% at the rim and over 40% from deep. He shot 73% at the rim this season, 41% from behind the arc. To me, that is the biggest key for this individual game and probably the biggest key for the Lakers if they crack the postseason party is how much is LeBron going to crank into that first gear and how often? You know, it's been a theme of this season. It was a theme of last season. This is a scary, scary LeBron James that we're looking at. And if he wants to, you know, crank it up a notch, if he wants to lock in and flip that switch, the Lakers are a really scary basketball team that I think pose a lot of problems for a lot of different teams in the field, man. So that's really my first key for this game and in the playoffs moving forward is, you know, how much does LeBron just want to lock in and dominate?
LeBron, when we are talking about these one and done, do or die, single game, he might still be one of the five guys who you want most on the planet. I had him number 8 overall for a playoff run because I do value those peaks that he can get to so much. At the same time, we just know that physically he can't sustain that load over a series or a run like some of these younger players can. But post All-Star break, he has been playing at such a ridiculous level, dude. 27.5 points and 9.5 assists per game on 67% true shooting, 58% from the field, 45% from three. When he is this level A jump shooter, and we always know that he is going to be this incredibly imposing downhill force and mismatch attacker and genius passer, he's just an unstoppable offensive player. And so my first key is, what the hell are the Pelicans going to do with LeBron? Because he got what he wanted in that game. And the facilitating was so incredibly impressive, how he controlled the game out of pick and roll. But as a scorer, straight up, we saw the Pelicans try various different options. They started the game with B.I. on LeBron, and we saw some Herb Jones. We saw some Trey Murphy, real quality perimeter defenders, but they're all quite slight. And so LeBron is just able to physically bully them. So the best option throughout that game ended up being Zion on LeBron, just because he can withstand the physicality of a LeBron drive in a way that these other dudes can. And so he forces him to settle for runners, or he forces him to settle for these tougher pull-up jumpers. But I think asking Zion to be the primary defender on LeBron for a whole game and then also be your best offensive player is just a lot to ask. And I think although in single coverage, Zion has held up very well, he's not going to be like the most resistant to switches, right? He's not necessarily going to fight super hard to stay on LeBron in all those actions. And so then LeBron is able to do his mismatch attacking, where it's okay, I can hunt Dyson Daniels, I can hunt CJ McCollum, I can hunt whoever it may be, and then he can go to work and bully those guys. So I think you will probably see Zion as the primary matchup on LeBron just because he guards him best, but I definitely think you'll see a combination. And I do wonder if we see Najee Marshall deployed at all. He didn't play at all in this game. I saw a good stat. Somebody replied on my tweet about how well Zion had guarded him, that Najee in a small sample size has guarded LeBron super well this year, and he just has that sort of build, right, as one of those more stout physical wings, and he's a quality player. But at the end of the day, I don't think there's a good answer here, and dialed in LeBron just tends to get what he wants. He tends to find that mismatch. He tends to find that advantage. And the problem is the Pelicans also don't have an answer for AD. And so that's where we saw LeBron AD pick and roll was absolutely unstoppable in this game, because they started with Valanciunas out there in a high drop coverage or in a conventional drop coverage. He was just too slow, and AD had his touch going, and so he makes some shots that maybe aren't always 100% for him, but really it was that combination of quickness and skilled shot making where he was just punishing Valanciunas for being too slow and being out of position. So then they just played him off the floor. But then you have Larry Nance at the five, who's still playing this drop coverage, and now you can basically just go over the top because he's too small and AD is too big and athletic and on the glass. Now you don't really have anybody to challenge AD. So he scored 16 points just as a role man in this game. And LeBron, even if it wasn't going to AD, when the Pelicans were in this sort of high drop and then tag look, you saw him make some incredible passes. I think about one spot where Dyson Daniels steps up as the low man and Rui cuts from the weak side and LeBron sneaks in this beautiful bounce pass. And LeBron just finds ways to avoid these tough matchups. If it's getting out in transition, so he's pushing the pace where he's at his best and nobody is like in that half court setting one-on-one, physically matching up with him. I just worry about the Pelicans finding answers to that Lakers two-man game. I think it's a really tough matchup for them.
And the fact that, I mean, they tried to double LeBron a bunch of scenarios too in this game where, I mean, it just opens up. He's one of the greatest playmakers ever, man. You can't do that to LeBron. If you're leaving somebody open, I mean, he's going to find him. It was, I don't know, man. I just haven't seen the Lakers, like, they've looked so good locked in during this stretch, man, that it's just, they're just going to be hard to stop. Like, defensively, too, the way they were turning, they played really hard. And I just wish we could get this Lakers team every night, man. They pushed the hell out of the tempo. They got out on the break. Like, they just looked unstoppable. And I don't really think New Orleans has an answer. And it would be a different dynamic if the Pelicans had more, like, just raw offensive punch, you know, where I just think they could generate points at a really high clip, but that's not how the Pelicans play games. You know what I mean? In a way, I feel like to beat LA, New Orleans would have to out-Lakers the Lakers, and I just don't think they can play that brand of basketball. You know what I mean? These are two really physical teams that win on defense and then convert those points into offense. They win defensively first. And when they can't stop the Lakers at all, even in the half court, it just kind of ruins the Pelicans' formula, right? I think to a game, about a month ago or so against Boston, right? They slowed Boston down in the first half. They generated a ton of points by getting out in transition and playing defensive hard-nosed basketball. They made Boston play their style. And then in the second half, it was like, okay, well, now go generate points in the half court, New Orleans. And they just couldn't. You know, Boston ran them out of the building in the second half. And I just don't think New Orleans has enough of that real, you know, high offensive punch where they're going to generate high shot quality every time down. Or even when they do generate these great shots, you know, they don't have a ton of shooters out there on the court that can punish, generating a ton of open looks. I just think New Orleans is a little outmatched, and this is a bad matchup for New Orleans, where I think they both play similar styles of basketball, but LA's just better at it. I think it would take nuclear Brandon Ingram. I think it would take Zion dominating. And that's the other aspect of this, Carson. I think LA has one of the best punches against Zion Williamson, you know, of any team in the league. They have the best kind of combination of defenders. They got a lot of size. They got one of the best interior defenders in all of basketball. They got LeBron, too, on the perimeter. You know, I believe Zion only scores 12 points in this game. It's just it's a big ask, man. And I think that's probably my other key, is Zion's going to have to figure out a way to carry this offense against a really stout defensive matchup. And I just think that LA just really matches up against New Orleans well.
I agree with everything you just said, man. You talk about how the Pels would kind of have to out Lakers the Lakers. Like, that is their identity, right? They are this team with a big physical front court. They have two dudes who can just bully a vast majority of modern NBA matchups with Zion and Valanciunas. They're a heavy points in the paint team. Friend of the show, Jason Timpf, tweeted out this pretty unbelievable stat. At one point during the game yesterday, the Lakers had a 50-12 points in the paint advantage against the Pels, who are both a top 10 paint offense and defense. And I do just think it's a tough physical matchup, because Zion Wright does hold up in terms of strength, but Valanciunas, although he's strong, we've talked about, just because of his lack of foot speed, he can kind of get played off the floor. And then the Pels are built to guard most modern NBA teams, right, with this plethora of long-rangey wings, Daniels and Herb Jones and Trey Murphy. Nazi Marshall, I mentioned, has a little bit more strength, but he's really long too. Like, they have all these versatile perimeter defenders, but the Lakers are the ultimate bully ball team. LeBron bullies you. Even Rui Hachimura, right, is an exceptionally physical big wing. And so they're just not as well built to stop this Lakers team as they are most offenses around the league. And then, like you said, LA is built to guard Zion, man. They have great collective personnel because they have these huge, strong wings. LeBron guarded him well. Rui guarded him well. AD, if that's a switch, if he's in single coverage against him, can absolutely hold up. And then he's a monster in those help situations. And there have been two games this year where Zion had 13 points or fewer against LA. And he was really his most effective in this game, facilitating, where the defense would sink in just a bit for help and then he would kick out to a shooter. But it's not the easiest matchup at all for him to go out there and have a dominant game offensively. And then I also think the Pels perimeter stars aren't a bad matchup for a Lakers perimeter defense that is flawed, because the Lakers are lacking in perimeter foot speed. That's where they can really get exploited, right? If they play against the Kings with Malik Monk and De'Aaron Fox, boom, those guys are just beating their guards off the bounce. When it's B.I. and C.J. McCollum, those are not quickness-based players. Those are tough shot makers, kind of regardless of the matchup. So it's not as problematic as other star perimeter duos can be. And then I just don't know what New Orleans does with Valanciunas. Like, I don't know if he can play, because he played 7 minutes in this game and a few of them came in the fourth quarter. And once he got back out there, he turned the ball over four times in like 3 minutes, mostly off of bad passes. But I think you have to give him more run than you did in this game, the 7 minutes, just because Nance at the five didn't work to me. But I'm not confident about Valanciunas working there either. I don't think it's a good fit defensively. And I think you kind of need the combination of Zion at least creating penetration, and then maybe your shooters can explode around him, and Valanciunas just clogs that up a little bit. Him and Nance are both pretty similar, though, honestly, in that they're like, if you leave us open, we'll shoot it, but they're not the most willing floor spacers. So I just find that New Orleans has a lot of problems without a lot of really good answers. There's a reason that LA destroyed them in this game. And by the way, the Pelicans like totally outshot them from deep. It didn't matter, right? They were down by 30 plus for a portion of this game. And then I think back to that in-season tournament game when you had dialed in LA and they beat them by like 40 something. The Lakers are just better, but they also match up really well against this Pelicans team. So I am taking them to win this one, presuming that they are not tanking and they take it seriously.
As am I. I think they have to play Valanciunas more. I just think you need his size out there. Like, I mean, they got killed in basically everybody's minutes, but
yeah,
Valanciunas was a comical negative 10 in 7 minutes. But I like with Nance, man, it was just so exploitable over the top. Like, he's a 6'8" 5 man, like with AD, with anybody out there. I mean, they're just going over the top. And yeah, I think you crushed one of your final points. That was something else I had written down. Ingram and McCollum just can't exploit the Lakers' biggest, you know, weakness on that other side is the point of attack guys. Like, that's why the Kings match up well, because Reeves and D'Lo can't cut them off. And because they get that initial pressure that puts the defense in rotation and makes everything else work, you know, Ingram and McCollum are over-the-top shot makers, where if they're not getting downhill and pressuring the rim, then you're not getting them in rotation, you're not getting the Lakers out of position, and basically all of the backline guys, Hachimura, LeBron, and AD, can just sink and stay in their spots. And so I just don't think the Pelicans really have any answer to easy offense against L.A., and they don't really have an answer to slowing them down on defense. So, yeah, I think the Pelicans are really overwhelmed here, and it's a bad matchup. If the Lakers are locked in, I'd say this is a decisive victory for L.A.
Lakers are scary, man. Lakers are scary. They're playing some real good basketball, and that offense is clicking like it arguably hasn't in the LeBron AD era. Like, if you want to talk about that 2020 title team, I'll definitely hear it. But the aggregate skill in the backcourt is certainly on a different level. Like, you had better versions of LeBron and AD that year, but the supporting cast, no question, is better.
Well, especially, I mean, in this recent stretch too, dude, with LeBron really taking on more of the lead guy, ball in his hands more.
Yeah.
And I know that was an issue that, you know, my roommate and some other guys pointed out, is like the Lakers didn't know how to play with LeBron on the floor. Dude, you've got guys backdoor cutting. You've got D'Lo doing give and goes, heading to the rack, man. Like, they're just playing better ball. Like, the Lakers look, they just look like a different team. And they're playing, you know, with LeBron as the center guy finally again. Lakers are scary, man. I don't care. I don't care what their record says. Oh, man, it's that LA bias. I don't care, man. The Lakers are scary.
They are. They sure are.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
What's up? I'm John Wall.
And I'm CJ Toledano, and we're starting a new podcast presented by DraftKings called Point Game. We're now joined by three-time NBA Sixth Man of the Year, elite bucket getter. Let's please welcome Jamal Crawford to Point Game. King of the Court one-on-one tournament. If they had it back in your prime, do you think you could have took it all?
I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think I could have took it all, but I think I would have shocked a lot of people. I think Kobe and everybody in their prime, Kobe would win a one-on-one contest.
Yeah, because you got to think, he's going to guard. He don't care about guarding.
He's going to guard.
He's going to guard. Like, you see him in the Olympics, he's going to guard. And then on top of
that. Like that, see that?
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Sam Cassell to Point Game.
I remember you came to my room crying tears. I mean, he was in a culture shock. And then he's going to withdraw us about winning.
Remember what I told you? I said, OG, you think I can get paid and go back and play in college? Because it ain't it.
Check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, DraftKings YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Jeff T from the Club 520 Podcast. You'll know when you get it. It'll say eBay, authenticity, guarantee. You'll feel it, because when it comes to your feet, eBay has your back. Maybe it's that head-turning pair for hooping or a hot new collab. Whatever you're after, when you cop on eBay, you can trust that your kicks will be checked by experts, not just any expert. Sneaker experts who live and breathe the culture. Real people with real hands-on authentication experience. That's when Blue Checkmark represents on our listing. eBay Authenticity Guarantee, meaning every inch, stitch, sole, logo is verified authentic through a detailed inspection. So when you finally step into those grill kicks, you'll realize the feeling is unlike any other. And with eBay Authenticity Guarantee, the feeling of real is always within reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Now, the 9-10 matchup, Logan, is also really fun, really exciting. We are just blessed with the play-in in the West this year. Of course, because it was a phenomenal year for the conference. Like, we're talking about all 46-plus win teams here, right? Warriors-Kings, they've played four times this year. They split the season series. Three of the four games were decided by 1 point, Logan. So it's been incredibly competitive. And we know they went 7, of course, in last year's playoffs. What's the first key that stands out to you in this matchup?
The first key is really, to me, just how the Kings generate consistent offense in this game. And I know that's kind of a weird key for Sacramento, right? Because that's their identity. Sacramento is this run-and-gun team where they're just going to go out and fill up and get buckets all game long. Without Malik Monk, I really am concerned about this team consistently generating easy offense, right? We saw 7 games of this series last year. And so we got a really good gauge of how these teams match up against each other. I think the Warriors are a better team than last year. And now that the Kings are without Malik Monk and Kevin Huerter, it's just a tough matchup, man. And the Kings offense has just been worse without Malik. This season, they averaged 117.4 points per game with Malik. They averaged 110.6 without him. Like, they lost a little punch. I know that's only 7 points, but that's a big difference without Malik.
Well, that's a big difference.
The Warriors are also just the hotter team. The Warriors have won 10 of their last 12. The Kings have lost 5 of their last 7. So the Warriors are healthier. They've got more playoff experience. And I just think they know how to play the Kings too, man. Like, I think we're going to see them dropping on Sabonis. They're going to try to get him to score. That's Sabonis' real weakness. And, you know, I think Fox is going to get what he wants. If Fox goes superhuman, this could be just a super superstar showdown. Who plays better? Is it Fox or is it Stephen Curry? I don't know if anybody can hold Fox on the perimeter. I mean, Fox got what he wanted last year. And if his jumper was on, it was like, all right, good luck, Golden State. To me, that's probably the biggest key, is the superstar showdown. Do we get superhuman Steph Curry? Do we not? Do we get superhuman De'Aaron Fox? Do we not? Is Fox's pull-up jump shooting hidden? Is Steph's pull-up jump shooting hidden? I think those are really big determinants. But I think the Kings are really hampered without Malik, and he is such a good release valve. Last season, when the Kings' offense got clogged up, it was just, we're just going to run pick and roll to death, and Fox and Malik are going to get down to the teeth of the defense. They're either going to get a layup at the rim, or they're going to kick it out to a shooter. And that worked really easily, but there's just a much larger burden on Fox's shoulders without having Kevin Huerter to space the floor, without having Malik Monk to take some of that pressure off of him and get downhill and do their thing. So it's an obvious point that you can make for any superstar matchup, but I really think the biggest key for this one is what kind of Fox and what kind of Curry do we get in this game?
These are two teams that are headed in basically complete opposite directions. There's kind of been nobody hotter than the Warriors and nobody colder than the Kings. You mentioned Dubs have won 10 of their last 12. Kings are just 3-6 since Malik got hurt. And so that is just a factor, period, point blank. The Dubs have looked like the much better basketball team as of late. But you also mentioned the Sabonis matchup. And I think that that is a bit problematic for Sacramento because, first of all, Draymond is like the guy who will most flagrantly just not guard him out to the perimeter. We'll literally just leave him out there and say, okay, beat us with your jump shooting. And Sabonis has to prove that he can hold them accountable for doing that. And I know that he's been more efficient from three this year, but it's small sample size, mid-range. He still really hasn't been very good. And then in terms of Sabonis' ability to score out of the post, using brute force, which is like his primary weapon, right? He's not the most skilled post scorer. What he does is lower his shoulder and hit you with an elbow, right? He's an incredibly physical post player. That doesn't work nearly as well against low center of gravity, crazy strong, absolute dog pest Draymond Green. And so that's a problematic matchup. I also think this is probably going to be more of a Kevon Looney game. We have seen him play less and less and less throughout the year because TJD is just better. He's better at this stage in their respective careers. But the ways to counter Sabonis, this groundbound but very physical big, are with strength and with physicality and with keeping him off the glass as well. And Looney was amazing at those things in the series last year. Absolutely ate him alive on the glass. And again, is just a more stout, physically mature defender than a TJD. So I think the Dubs have pretty good answers for Sabonis in that respect. And then the other interesting dynamic to me when we look at the other side of the ball is how do the Kings try to counter Steph Curry? Because he has owned them over these last couple years. Last two regular seasons combined, he's dropping 32 points per game on 73% true shooting against Sacramento in the playoffs. It was one of the best series of his career. He gave them 34 a night on 63% true shooting. They are one of the defenses that struggles more to keep him from getting penetration. You think about that game 7 last year where he scored, like, I want to say it was basically a career high playoff points in the paint when he had 50 in that game. And in the last matchup this regular season, they had a lot of trouble keeping track of him off ball. And I think that maybe the most interesting question is just who do they guard him with? Because they turned to Keegan Murray primarily in the late stretch of that last game, who guards him pretty well on ball. Like, Steph's a little bit quicker, but it's not necessarily an overwhelming advantage. And then Keegan is just their best perimeter defender, and he's big and he's long, so he can affect some of those Steph pull-up jumpers. But he had a bit of a hard time navigating some of those off-ball screens because he's just not quite as quick there. And also, right, he's bigger. It's easier to catch him up with some of those screens. So Steph was able to spring open for a good amount of quality looks off-ball. So Davion Mitchell is always an option in these series who they can bring in as just a Steph hound, right? Give you 15, 18 minutes just applying ball pressure, picking him up, full court attached to him off-ball. But ultimately, I don't think they have found a good answer. What do you think they try to do with Steph? And do you like the formula for them? Like, do you think they find any success? No.
Do I like the formula?
Yeah.
No. Yeah. I mean, against Steph Curry, no, I don't. I would. Those are the two guys I'd point to. Keegan and then Davion. I don't think either work. I don't think there's like a solution for Steph.
Yeah.
He's just too quick. You know, with Keegan, it's like Keegan's an awesome defender. When you're talking about those guys who are like right below, like all defense level guys, Keegan's right there.
Absolutely.
I mean, he's one of the best defenders in the NBA. And so I'm not saying he's not like well equipped to do it, but I think you point out the fatal flaws, like quickness, agility, and the Warriors just do such a good job of setting up stuff for him that's not, you know, straight up easy to defend. It's not always just going to be a pick and roll with the ball in his hands at the top of the key where, you know, defenders do that every game. You know, that's a relatively easy action to defend. It's still Steph Curry, but it's simple. The Warriors do so many other things. I think it's tough. And then Davion, it's like, yeah, Davion's strong, but Davion's small. Like, he just doesn't have the arms to contest those shots. Steph Curry's release is so quick. If he gets to his spot, it's like Davion's just not going to be able to contest that. I don't think the Kings really have an answer. And then the other big thing is, I mean, not only are the Warriors playing better basketball, I think the rotation's better. And then I think they just have more guys that can switch on to their best offensive players and counter what they do. I mean, the Warriors kind of had a spoil of riches to throw at these guys. If it's Fox, if it's Keegan, if it's Sabonis, I mean, you know, if you're throwing Wiggins, if you're throwing Kuminga, if you're throwing TJD, if you're throwing Draymond, like Gary Payton, you know, the second, like, they have so many guys that can just easily switch onto the Kings' best players where I don't know if the Kings can really get them in trouble. I think the Kings are just a little overmatched here. You said, dude, Steph kind of, Steph's kind of their dad. Steph kind of owns the Kings. So,
yeah,
it's tough. I don't know. And again, it's a one game scenario. Crazy things happen, but at this point, with the losses of Monk and Herder, I just think the Warriors have more quality guys to turn to, and their guys have been playing better ball. Wiggins has been playing better ball. Klay's had a couple good games. Draymond, you know, Draymond's been playing better. Like, guys are just rounding into form, and it feels like, not like old Warriors where I think they're going to go on a title run or something, but, you know, they're playing good Warriors ball, which is terrifying.
I agree. They do just have more quality players. They have more options. Their depth has been a clear strength of the roster all year, but also that bench has just gotten shorter and shorter for the Kings, obviously, with the loss of two key rotation players. So I do think Sacramento is going to be very, very reliant on De'Aaron Fox to play a hell of a game in this one. Their offense just hasn't been as productive. They're only 13th in offensive rating since Malik got hurt, which isn't awful, but this is a team that has to be really good offensively if they want to win against these quality teams. They're not going to win on the back of their defense, even though they're improved there from last season. And so I think the level of pull-up shooting we get from De'Aaron Fox is a real key in this game, because he has played incredibly well against the Warriors this year. He's given them 32-5-5, but he shot really well from deep, 42% on 8 attempts per game across those matchups. And we saw last year, like, the Warriors can't really stay in front of him. Kind of nobody can stay in front of De'Aaron Fox. And so the best thing you can do is concede those pull-up jumpers and hope that he misses, because he can put on his clinics, especially from the mid-range, but he also has his stretches where he'll go cold. And this year he's been super streaky. He was 44% from deep in December. Then he was under 33% in January, February, 34% in March, and now he's been up above 40% again in April. So if he is knocking down those shots, that's where he has the potential to just absolutely explode. But if I'm the Warriors, I think we have to prioritize conceding those looks, because we can't just let him get downhill against us all game. And then I just wonder, like, can anybody else create offense from the perimeter? Because Malik was that guy. Malik was the guy who last year in that playoff series gave you 19 a game on 58% true shooting, 8 up free throws, consistently created penetration. And now it's like, I like Keon Ellis, man. Keon Ellis is not doing what Malik Monk did. And so it does just feel like the Warriors are the better team with more talent, considering the Kings' absences, playing better basketball right now. And I do like some of these key matchups. I also think, especially if Keegan is guarding Steph, the Warriors' athletes have a real chance to shine, because we saw stretches last year where if you get a mismatch where it's Draymond or it's Wiggins on one of these Kings guards and they're aggressive and physical, that's problematic. Same thing obviously goes for Kuminga, who is kind of the rare Warrior who hasn't been playing his best basketball as of late. He's been a little bit out of rhythm working his way back from that injury, but he has the opportunity to definitely attack some mismatches in this game. And the Kings do not have a lot of rim protection because it's Sabonis holding things down there. So Wiggins has played really well against them. Kuminga, I think, again, can attack there. So I just see more advantages for the Warriors. They're playing much better. So I'm picking them in this one.
I'm also going to take the Warriors, but I'm glad you mentioned Keon Ellis. To me, he's the guy that's got to step up. And it's a lot to ask. You know, it's a lot to ask. This guy was G League, you know, start of the year. They called him up. He's been playing great. I want to give a big shout out to Keon. Like, he's shooting over 40% from behind the arc post All-Star break. He's been giving the Kings really solid minutes, but it's a lot to ask a slight frame guard who has to play that above his means. You know what I mean? You're asking this kid to probably put up a 20 piece and knock down 4 or 5 threes from behind the arc, get downhill and create rim pressure, create shots for his teammates. Like, Keon's been playing really good ball, but you're just asking him to play so far above his means. And then, you know, he's also slighter than Malik and Herder too. Like, he's twitchy, he's fast, but I believe he's like, you know, 6'3", a buck 70.
He's taller than that, but he's very slight.
Yeah, he is a slight guy. Keon's going to have to play the game of his life, I think. And I think Fox is just going to have to be drilling pull-up jumpers. It's just a lot to ask for the Kings. So we're aligned here. I'm also going to take the Warriors to win this game.
And that specific element of creating penetration, getting downhill that Malik brought, like, Keon's just not bringing that, right? He really is about, okay, can I get hot from three? And he's a really good shooter, but it's just a different dimension. Like, Malik was able to threaten that defense beyond what the raw box score would indicate because of where he was getting on the floor so consistently. So I'm taking the dubs in this one. The NBA season is in full swing, and when I can't get enough of the action on the court, I spice things up by betting on DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA. And right now, new customers bet $5 and get $150 instantly in bonus bets. And North Carolina listeners, don't forget, DraftKings Sportsbook is now live in your state.
Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now and use code NERDS. New customers can bet $5 to get $150 instantly in bonus bets. Only at DraftKings Sportsbook with code NERDS. The crown is yours.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Or in West Virginia, visit 1-800-GAMBLER.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas, 21 and over, age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.co/bball for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources.
Let's move out east, Logan, where the 7-8 is very interesting, man. We've talked about it. These are two of the top four, top five teams out east when you're talking about the playoff threat they pose, and yet here they are in the 7-8 matchup for their own reasons. Sixers Heat, what's the first key to you here?
How do they affect Joel Embiid? How does Miami affect Joel Embiid, and what kind of version of Embiid do we get? Since Embiid returned, Philly is 5-0 in games he's played in. He's putting up 30 points per game, 9 boards, 5 assists on 49% from the field and 48% from behind the arc. He is averaging 5 turnovers per game as well, but, I mean, just super efficient, knocking down his 3. I'm going to say this point blank. Like, if Philadelphia gets this version of Joel Embiid, if we get a 30-point outing, 5 assists, 10 boards this efficiently, Philadelphia is going to win this basketball game. I just don't think Miami has the requisite offensive talent to compete with that. Because when you get that superstar version of Joel Embiid, guess what that does? It maximizes Tyrese Maxey and allows him to cook, because you have to divert so much attention to Joel Embiid. It allows Kelly Oubre to go do his thing and backdoor cut and get open looks. It allows Tobias Harris to cook and do his thing. It just, Joel Embiid dominating like this. And again, I know Bam is a great, one of the best defenders on planet Earth. He's on my all-defense team. He just is. Is he going to have an answer for Joel Embiid? I don't know. That's the first key, man. They got to slow him down, because if Embiid is knocking down his mid-range jumpers, if he's hitting from deep, it is going to open up everything offensively, and I think Philly is going to run. You've got to make this a rock fight. You got to make it grimy. You got to muck it up. And I don't know if that's throwing, you know, I think you got to throw a lot of different defensive coverages, and Miami probably is that team. Like, Eric Spoelstra is an evil genius. If he's going to cook up something for this play-in game, he's the guy to do it. He is the mastermind. But I think you got to come up with some kind of scheme. You got to throw him, you know, surprise doubles on the baseline in the corner, trying to trap him. You just got to make Joel Embiid uncomfortable, man. And I know he's had his playoff collapses and shortcomings, but he has looked slimmer. You know, he's just looked damn good in his return, man. If Embiid looked off, or if Embiid looked, you know, like 70% of the player he was, you know, right now I'm getting 90 to 95 of what Embiid was before he got hurt. If we get that Joel Embiid, I'm comfortably taking Philly to win this game. So key number one, Miami's got to make Embiid uncomfortable.
That is obviously the key to this game, is how do you deal with the Joel Embiid problem? And we saw this matchup within the last couple weeks, and I thought that Miami guarded him pretty well. Bam is an interesting matchup because Embiid does have this pretty significant size and strength advantage, but it's a different dynamic where Jokic will basically just go back to the basket, right, and kind of bully Bam and then get to these little touch shots, which we know he's super efficient with. Embiid pretty strongly prefers facing up when you're talking about his post-up attack, and so Bam's quickness advantage is a little bit more of a factor, and Embiid often will kind of get tempted into just taking his face up and pull up jumpers, because there he has the size advantage. He can get those shots off cleanly over Bam. And so then the success of his offensive approach just kind of depends on if those jumpers are falling. And for the most part, they do. But we have seen in those playoff environments, they often have not. But Miami was pesky with those doubles. And most importantly, they went to zone, and that just changed the game. Like, Philly scored 12 points on 28 possessions versus Miami's zone. And it worked basically to perfection. They got Philly to miss a bunch of threes, some of which were solid looks, but not necessarily like wide open threes. And they got them into that rhythm where they weren't really creating penetration. They were just kind of taking one pass, catch and shoot threes. When Embiid caught it around the nail and got into the teeth of that zone, he was pestered. There were a lot of dudes converging on him, and he missed a lot in that range. They didn't force a lot of turnovers against Embiid, but they did make him uncomfortable. But ultimately, the problem was Miami was generating stop after stop after stop, but then Philly was generating stop after stop after stop. And even though Embiid didn't have his most dynamic offensive game, and even though that zone worked and it got them like an 8-point lead in the fourth quarter, Maxey had a great game, Oubre got a couple of timely buckets, and Miami just couldn't keep up. And that's the biggest concern for them on the opposite side of the ball, is can they score enough, and how do they deal with Embiid's defense? Because this is a team that is small and is not very athletic. And when you have a massive man and one of the league's best rim protectors like Joel Embiid in the paint, it was just a real struggle for Miami to score down there. And so Jimmy, I think, is going to have to be nails for mid-range. He's going to have to get to those looks with Embiid playing out a drop, and he's going to have to punish them for giving him those looks. And the Heat, I think, are going to have to shoot really well from deep, because I just think we've seen against like these huge teams, they're not going to score enough around the bucket. And Embiid is also specifically a tough matchup for Bam, because he struggles with those huge dudes as well. And he tends to rely a lot on his touch shot making. And sometimes that's a good thing, and he's making those looks at a 50-55% clip. And then sometimes he just goes ice cold and he's missing floater after floater after floater. But against a dude as big and strong as Embiid, he's not going to get a lot of good looks around the rim. So that's my biggest concern for Miami offensively. Embiid is a problem defensively, but like, they're just so damn pesky, and Spo is so good. Like, I think they can knock Embiid off his game a little bit. I'm just not sure that they have enough firepower to even take advantage of that.
Those are real concerns. I think Jimmy's going to get whatever he wants. I have that level of faith in Jimmy.
Okay. Well, I know you do.
I don't know if
he's your god.
I mean, yeah, dude, I put Jimmy on a pedestal. Like, any matchup that they put on him defensively, if it's in isolation, if he's using pick and roll with Bam, because that was a lot of their attack. It was, damn it, somebody give Jimmy a screen at the top of the key and let Jimmy go figure it out. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that's kind of Miami's offensive formula. That's why it's so hard for them to generate points, because they're not super dynamic. There's not, like, backdoor cutters, and it's mostly, hey, give Jimmy a screen, let him get to the mid-range. If he's got a look, he's going to pull up. If he doesn't, he's going to kick it back out to a shooter. It's very simple. It's effective. So I think Jimmy's going to get what he wants. I'm expecting a basic Jimmy game. 20-plus points, 5 boards, 5 assists. It's really going to come down to, Hero's going to be out here for the game, too. Rozier's going to be out there. Like, they got to have flamethrower shooting performances. But I'm really glad that you brought up Philly's length, because I think it is problematic. A lot of their looks, like, they just have guys with long wingspans that fundamentally, even if Jimmy's getting into the teeth of the defense and collapsing them a little bit, Philly has so many long defenders that I don't know if it really matters, you know, him generating these shots. Like, if he's going up against a bunch of small guards, well, he's creating real advantages because they can't close out fast enough to contest those shots. But you've got Oubre, you've got Tobias Harris, you've got Batum, you've got Tyrese Maxey. All of these guys can close out relatively easy while cheating to help get rid of get the ball out of Jimmy's hands in the paint. So there's a huge burden on those shot makers to just kill them. I think we got to get a flamethrower, Hero, Rozier. I think all those guys have to be knocking down shots. I think, like you said, too, with Bam, I think Bam has to be knocking down these little baby floater touch shots. And guess what, Carson? In this hypothetical scenario where all these things go right for Miami, I think it's still a tight game. Mm-hmm. That's what sucks, is because if all these things go right, if Miami is knocking down every three, if Jimmy's getting into the teeth of the defense and hitting his mid-range shots, and Bam is hitting his mid-range shots, and Miami is slowing down Philly on the other end, it's like, all right, Miami's got a five-point lead at the end of the game. You know, I mean, Philly's going to be right there within striking distance.
But you have Miami above Philly on your contender.
By one. By one. I mean, it's very marginal. And the reason that is...
you're talking about Philly like they're the clearly stronger team and Miami's fighting uphill here.
I mean, if Embiid puts up a 30-piece, yeah, they're going to win. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of the thing. But I do think Miami can slow them down enough. That's my thing. I'm going to take Philly in this game. It's a one-game format. I think they've got the best player on the court. I'm taking Philly because I just think they match up really well against Miami. I'm always going to give Miami a fighting chance against any team because they've shown it. They've shown it too many times. But that's my thing. I think if all the things go right for Miami, they've got like a two-possession lead at the end of this game where Philly could still steal it. And I think if everything goes right for Philadelphia in this game, they probably win by 10+. I think it could be a blowout. So it's weird, man, because I always just think in all of these hypothetical matchups, it's like Miami is so overmatched. They seem so overwhelmed, and it just doesn't make sense. I don't know. Maybe Miami pulls out their voodoo magic, their special playbook. You know, Eric Spoelstra does a little seance before the game, and they get they do their magic thing. I just think Philly's a matchup problem. They're bigger. They've got the size advantage. I think they've got the best player in the field, and that's what it comes down for me, man. I just think Embiid is going to be the best player on the floor, and that matters. So I'm going to take Philly in this one-game format. I give Miami a shot, man, but I just think there's so many things that have to go right for Miami to win this game.
They definitely have more boxes to check. They often do, and sometimes they check off all of those boxes, but it definitely feels like there's more paths to Philly winning this game. I absolutely believe Miami can make this ugly and will make this game ugly and will make Embiid work. But Philly just has more offensive pop. They have the best player on the floor by a good margin. And like, there's a real world in which they have the two best offensive players on the floor. Jimmy, I know you love him, Logan. I know you believe in him eternally. But like, who has more offensive explosions as of late? It's Tyrese Maxey, right? If he's knocking down all his pull-up threes, good night. He can drop 50 on you. He's done it three times this year. And there's a reason Philly's 31-8 when Joel Embiid plays. It's because they're actually quite talented and they're quite good. And Miami, they're 24th in offensive rating, right? Like, that is reflective of the reality for them this year. It feels like a grind pretty much every time out. The one last little thing that intrigues me, I wonder how much Kevin Love we see in this game. Just because last matchup, he was like shockingly good. He was plus 25 in 19 minutes, but he also ate up rebounds, 16 boards in those 19 minutes. And when he was matched up with Embiid at the five, it was actually like kind of the most fluid that Miami's offense looked because Embiid had to actually respect the floor spacing big, and so he couldn't be as impactful as a rim protector. So I don't love playing Kevin Love big minutes at this stage, and I do think when he's on the floor defensively, it's like, yeah, he's stout, but you're going to have to send a lot of doubles Embiid's way or zone up or do something creative. But he had an impact in the last game, and so I do wonder if they turn to him again in this one.
I think it's a huge key. I think you have to give Kevin Love a ton of burn in this game. And you just got to hope he does well. I mean, I do think physically, like, you know, he's not a complete zero against Embiid, too. Like, Kevin Love's still a strong guy. Mm-hmm. And he can swing a game. Again, that's the one weird thing about Miami, too, is I talk about, you know, Philly does match up with them lengthwise. The scary thing about Miami is in these one-game environments is when they can make it a grimy game, they have shooting on the wings. Like, everywhere. Hero, you know, Rozier, they've got Love. Martin can get hot. Duncan Robinson. Jaime Jaquez is spotty, but he can hit. You know, they've got shooting on the wings that swings games too. You know, every team does, but it's like they've got actual shooters that can get really hot and in rhythm and help swing a game. So I would never count Miami out of a one game scenario, and I think it's going to be a grimy tight game. But in scenarios like this, Give me the team with more offensive pop. I don't even think it's close. I think just Philly is in a different stratosphere. And give me the team with the best basketball player. I think that's Philly.
We agree. All right, 9-10 game out east. Bulls-Hawks. I think we can sort of speed run through this one. Jokic Joestar said he'd be good if they just simmed this one, and I agree. I think this is the worst play-in game that we've had in the years of the play-in. Like, I'm sure there have been some 9-10s out east that weren't great, but the Hawks are a 36-win team. The Bulls are a 39-win team. Just give me your pick in this one. Who are you taking?
I mean, who cares? You know what? Yeah. I'm not even going to do this. I'm going to use this as a the Chicago Bulls finally played Adama Sanogo the other night. He put up a 20-20 game.
April stat lines.
Cut Nikola Vucevic. Start Adama Sanogo. Reps. I don't know, man. This is a weird game. Give me Chicago, I guess.
I'm going to take Chicago, too, just because they actually care about basketball, and I'm not sure that the Hawks do. And also, the Hawks are just down so many guys, man. No Onyeka, no Jalen Johnson, no Sadiq Bey. Of course, the Bulls have been out some of their guys for an extended stretch. LaVine and Patrick Williams obviously both done for the year for quite some time. But the Bulls just grind, man. Bulls are playing good basketball as of late. They made that Knicks game tough. I mean, they were just hounding them defensively down the stretch. I've never seen a team struggle to inbound the ball legitimately as much as New York was against Chicago. Caruso is a good matchup for Trae Young, and Atlanta does scare me in this matchup just because, like, they have clearly the best offensive player on the floor, but it's Trae Young three games into working his way back into form, and they're just down so many quality players, big athletes in the front court. Just give me the team that's been playing better, but I don't think this is exactly going to be the peak of the play-in experiment. Play-in's awesome, and it made the home stretch of this regular season really fun because, like, you're playing for seeding and stuff down to the very last minute, but we probably didn't need this 9-10 matchup out east. Okay, so there it is for the play-in. Now let's talk about the playoffs themselves, Logan. We're going to preview two series, starting with the one that was set in stone first and is probably the most exciting first-round matchup, or at least the one that we know for sure is going to happen at this stage, Clippers-Mavs. We talked about this one on Jason's show, Hoops Tonight. You guys can go back and listen to that conversation we had, or you can just stick around and hear what we have to say here. What's your first key to this series, Logan?
My first key is very simple. It's just, how do the Clippers match up with one of the best offensive players on the planet? It's very simple, but Luka Doncic just creates easy offense so effortlessly. I mean, the one thing that I'm really focused on is, one, the different combinations that they throw at him. Jason mentioned this on his show, and I think it's the inevitable conclusion that we're going to reach in this series, is it's going to be Kawhi Leonard most likely on Luka Doncic, or it's going to be Paul George. Like, they just have to step up and lock him down. And I think physically they can match up with him, but there's no really taking away a guy that has so many counters and so many things in his bag. And especially too, man, when the Mavs just have Luka standing at 35 feet away from the basket, they give him a high pick and roll, and it's like, go figure it out, defense. Good luck. Like, once that guy sets the screen, if it's Lively or Gafford, they are then effectively running full speed to the hoop where your center has to fully drop back. We've created space between Luka and the wing guy. Luka's going to get to the elbow. He's either going to pull the shot. Your help side guy is going to drop. He's going to kick it out to the shooter in the corner. He's going to have a wide open three. Or your center stepped up on Luka and he throws a lob over the top. That action creates such easy offense for Dallas because Luka is the man. And it's just going to be a nightmare. Like, that's, you got to figure out how to deal with that and how to slow down Luka, man. Luka ate on every team this year. We know his stat line, but specifically against the Clippers this year, he put up 34 points per game, 6 boards a night, 7 assists a night on 52, 32, 74 splits. They threw everybody at him.
That's actually a rough showing for Luka. Those are below the averages. If Luka Doncic did that, his averages would go down.
Literally, his averages would go down. If Carson Brewer lost in Trivia Gauntlet, his averages would go down, man.
True.
They put Kawhi on him. They put PJ on him. They put Big Zoo on him. They put Terrence Mann on him. They put Russ on him. It didn't matter. Luka ate on everybody. So, again, to state the obvious, the first key, how the hell do you slow down Luka Doncic? Can Kawhi or Paul George really affect this guy at all and wear him down? I mean, that's the one thing I think maybe we have seen a little bit in series, Carson. Like, do you think that, what do you think about, like, Luka's conditioning? Like, do you think the Clippers can really wear him down, like, in a 6-7 game series where he's, I mean, he's got, finally, like, he's got Kyrie to lean on this year. Do you think they can tire him out over the length of an entire series? Do you think they can get him tired to the point where maybe he has a, you know, off game 5, off game 6, just because he's so worn down from having such an offensive burden on his shoulders?
I think Luka is one of those dudes who is just built to carry an exceptional offensive load. I mean, he's one of the highest usage players in league history, and he's done that year after year after year. And we've seen him consistently hold up at a pretty incredible level throughout these playoff series. The one thing I would say is, if you want to try to target him defensively, make him work on that end as much as possible, like, that's a way to put even more of a burden on him. But in terms of carrying that load offensively, he's just kind of built for it. He's going to control the pace to the exact tempo that he wants. He is built for these physical environments. The guy's a tank. And he really is, like, one of the most exceptionally difficult offensive players to take away, just because there's so many different actions out of which he is entirely dominant, and so many different ways in which he is entirely dominant at this stage in his career, right? He, out of pick and roll, as you mentioned, gets to the paint at will, and then he's an unbelievable touch shot maker, shoots like 55% on floaters, and can make every pass, lob passes, skip passes. He's just phenomenal. And now he's the best as a three-point shooter he's ever been. So in isolation, he can bully most defenders and get into the lane, or he can kill you with those step backs. He can attack mismatches out of the post, all the while being able to pick you apart with whatever necessary pass. Like, the man is just effectively unstoppable. So sometimes when a player is of that caliber, the best thing you can do is just force the ball out of their hands. And generally, I don't think that's the best thing you can do, because basically allowing any offense to just play 4-on-3 is a very perilous game. But I am leaning more and more towards the idea that the Clippers should mix in a heavy, heavy mix of traps and blitzes on Luka here and force the Mavs to beat them with their spot-up shooting. The Mavs average 1.1 points per possession on all Luka pick and rolls. That's an exceptional number. When teams have trapped him, though, that number drops to just 0.89. So that is a huge difference in terms of the offensive efficiency. And that's not a Luka thing. Like, we've seen in recent years, the Mavs have actually become more efficient when you trap Luka, which is the case for a lot of great offensive players, because they make the right decisions and they put their teammates in positions to attack with a full 4-on-3 advantage. But I think it's the drop-off in spot-up shooting, where Derrick Jones Jr., PJ Washington have their moments, have their stretches. They're not the most consistent spot-up shooters. And when I mentioned this and we were on with Jason, he made a good point as well, I thought, which is that if you keep setting those traps and therefore you start to deter Luka from running pick and roll at all, like, let's say if those guys just aren't knocking down those spot-up jumpers, or if he just gets tired of constantly having the ball forced out of his hands, you force him into more ISOs against Kawhi Leonard, who is, like, as well built as anybody to guard him in single coverage. Elite perimeter defender straight up, but also the sort of guy who has the strength to hold up against Luka in a way that a lot of people can't. So that's a tough matchup. So I have a bunch of faith in Luka getting what he wants, but I think blitzing him and making the Mavs beat you with their spot-up shooting is going to be key for the Clippers in this series. And if those shots are falling, well, then tough luck. Nothing you can do. But if they're missing, then you've opened the door in a way that you might not be able to playing Luka with these traditional coverages where he's just more comfortable.
Yeah, and you know what? That's a good point. Like, the Clippers might get burnt a couple of games, but that's the key, right? You're playing the percentages, and that might be the best avenue to steal enough games, because that's a goal, man. You're not trying, obviously you're trying to win every game, but it's like, you just need four. And if you can have enough of those off shooting nights from PJ, from Derrick Jones Jr., who aren't the most reliable shooters, you open something up, and you're taking him away. That being said, Luka finally does have one of the best co-stars of his career in Kyrie Irving, which opens up a different dynamic where you also got to slow him down. Kyrie is, I mean, the perfect, partner in crime for anybody on offense. Another interesting aspect on the other side of the ball is how dominant Dallas's defense has been since getting Gafford in Washington. They're the number one defense over the last 15 games. They've got a sub-110 defensive rating with Daniel Gafford and P.J. Washington. And I think they've got a good pair of wings to throw at P.G. And Kawhi. You know, I like P.J. Washington. I like Derrick Jones Jr. I think Kawhi and P.G. are going to get whatever they want. I just have that faith in them as offensive players. If Kawhi is healthy, playoff Kawhi is a different animal. He is a different beast. I think he's going to get where he wants. I think he's going to do his thing. I think Dallas provides a good deterrent, but it's Kawhi and Paul George. And Paul George has been on a heater. He has been playing some of the best ball of his career. So those guys are going to eat. Then I turn to the next three guys, or next four guys that I really think are going to swing the series. What do we get out of Norman Powell, Russell Westbrook, and James Harden? I think those guys are crucial, crucial offensive factors in swinging the series for LA. I think they need red-hot shooting from behind the arc alongside Kawhi and PG. And then I just think they need Russ and Harden to pull their weight. And those are two really big swing factors for me. They're just variables. You know, I honestly, Carson, at this point in the season, I think I might have more faith in Russell Westbrook pulling his weight and doing his job more than James Harden. I'm very out on Harden. I've mentioned this on every show, and I've read these numbers on every show we've done mentioning this series and the Clippers. James Harden's been horrible. I mean, 16% top of the key, 33% on wing threes, 31% on the corner, 27% on catch and shoot attempts, 21% on open threes, and 31% on wide open threes. If you're getting that James Harden, I think he's unplayable. I think he's a negative defensively, and then I think you're getting a guy who is a zero offensively. And sure, you know, Harden can set the table. There's a different level, man. When you are that much of a non-factor scoring the basketball, it's like, why am I putting you on the court? Man, I might turn to Bones Highland in that situation.
Oh, my God.
I don't want Bones Highland minutes, man. But if James Harden is doing that for you offensively, why are you even out there? He's got to pull his weight, man. And I know he's going to be matched up against a lesser defender because that's just his role now. You know, he's the third guy instead of being the number one or the number two guy. But Harden's been horrible. And if this is the version that we get out of him, I'm that much more confident in Dallas pulling out the series. Like I said, Kawhi and PG are going to do their thing. But to me, it's about Powell hitting his open threes. It's about Russ doing his thing. And it's about Harden hitting open looks. Again, I will reiterate, Harden is shooting 21% on open threes, 31% on wide open threes, and 27% off the catch. Like, that's just a horrible off-ball player, along with a guy who's lost a ton as an on-ball creator. He doesn't explode. He doesn't get downhill anymore. He does not create rim pressure. He does not create advantages. He stands there and goes, I'll shoot this pull-up three. I'll shoot this step-back three. He's got one shot in his bag, man. And so, because of the attention that Luka demands, like, here's the thing, like, because Luka creates such high shot quality for his teammates may not be as offensively talented as the Clippers' depth, but he's going to create wide open looks for those guys all game long. If it's Green, if it's Exum, if it's Washington, if it's Derrick Jones Jr., if it's Kleba, whoever, those guys are going to get great shot quality and great looks. Kawhi and PG don't create those kind of advantages. Like, Harden is still going to have to create some of those shots for himself. And he's going to have to hit the open looks, which he hasn't been doing. So, you know, I may like the Clippers' offensive punch and their depth more, but they've got a lot more weight on their shoulders where the Mavericks' role players, their roles are really simplified. That's the beauty of playing with a Luka Doncic, of playing with a Nikola Jokic. Your role becomes so simplified where you got to defend really well and you got to hit open shots. And I just think that the Mavericks role players are just more well equipped to do that than the Clippers. I may like the name brand of the Clippers depth a little more, but I trust the Mavericks role players to just do their jobs more.
I prefer the Mavs offensive formula, and it does start with Luka. He's just one of those absolutely ridiculous players who is so great as both a scorer and playmaker that he gets you a good shot no matter what. And when I propose the best strategy is probably to trap and blitz him as much as possible, it's like the battle's kind of been lost at that point because it's really hard to guard 4-on-3. Like, that's the reality. That is just saying, man, this guy is so damn good that we would rather allow you play offense with an extra man than just let him go to work on us. And then Kyrie has been playing at such a great level as of late. Over his last 10 games, 27.5 points per game on 66% true shooting. So I think the Mavs offensive formula is fantastic. And even though I think the Clippers defense has sucked for a couple months, they are pretty well equipped to guard the Mavs because they have good perimeter defenders. I think those perimeter defenders mostly just haven't cared because they're in their early mid-30s and they had already locked up a top four seed in the playoffs. And it's not abnormal to have some fatigue at that stretch of the season. Now, they do have to dial back in pretty quickly here, and I don't think they're the best defense, but I think they're solid there. What's interesting also is the challenge that the Clippers offense presents, though, because Logan, you can diminish James Harden. I know you don't believe in the guy whatsoever. He's been awful as of late. We have still seen stretches of this year where he is a very impactful offensive player because he is so smart as a playmaker. No, don't do that. Don't do that. We have seen stretches this year that's undeniable where he's an efficient scorer.
Carson, are you
your third perimeter defender and he's able to torch those guys in isolation? One of the biggest problems has just been that he can't make these pull-up jumpers that normally he makes quite efficiently as of late. Like, I don't want James Harden to be the guy who I'm basing my offense off of at all because of his issues as a rim pressure and rim finisher and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You just take things too far sometimes, man, and then you look at me like I'm the crazy one.
This is
talking about taking Bones Highland over James Harden.
What I'm saying is this is a really big sample size, and it's like shooting is a rhythm thing. When you are in rhythm as a shooter, when you have a good game, I'm not saying it's an 100% thing, but normally when shooters are hitting, you're hitting the next game. Your shot
and
is just dialed in.
I am concerned about James Harden. You're talking about him like he's an absolute bum.
He kind of is at this point. He's washed.
No.
Harden's washed, man.
Dude, I think you are understating the potential impact he at least can have in this series. And what I think is interesting then is how do the Mavs get their best combination of defenders on the floor? Because you have two good wing options. PJ, 6'7", 230, 7'3 wingspan, springy athlete, has been defending quite well in Dallas. I think he's a good matchup for Kawhi. Derek Jones Jr., a little bit slighter, but also very long. I think he's a good matchup for PG. And this is another thing we talked about, Jason. Then how do you handle James Harden? Maybe with your starting five, the primary matchup is Kyrie Irving, which is okay. I think Kyrie would fare all right in that matchup. But there are some other ways to try to go about it. You can try to basically play Zubats off the floor, go small with Kleba at the five. Really not that small. I mean, you're still decently big in the front court. PJ at the four and Kleba, who's 6'10 and stout, at the five. That, to me, would be an absolute win for the Mavs if they can do that, because if both these teams go small, then the Mavs are getting their best perimeter defensive combination on the floor. Then, I mean, they have a real five-out offense. They have shooters everywhere, but they're also just bigger in their small ball configuration than the Clippers are, who I really don't like in those looks very much in a post-Nick Batum world. But I am not so confident that you can play Zubats off the floor. And again, it's not like Kleba is small for a five, but Zubats is just huge. And I think he's going to be able to go over the top as a lob threat in those looks out of pick and roll. I think he can abuse some post mismatches there. He's a 92nd percentile post score there. He's like the second best paint touch shot maker in the league in terms of efficiency, only to Nikola Jokic. I think he presents a problem on the glass there. So if the Mavs can go small, I think that is a winning configuration for them. But if Zubats doesn't allow that to happen, which I think he's probably going to make it tough, I think he is probably going to punish the Mavs with his offense and rebounding. Dante Exum is a very intriguing option, in my opinion, who I wish we had talked about more. And I think he works in various configurations. First of all, he can just be like a Derek Jones Jr. replacement, because if Derek Jones Jr. isn't making a shot, well, Exum brings you very similar size and point of attack defense, but then has been a 49% three-point shooter this year. So he's just a guy who I trust more to knock down those open looks. Or if you're looking at these staggered lineups where you have either Luka or Kyrie on the floor, I think he presents an awesome option as like the point of attack defensive guard and spot up shooter alongside them. So then no matter what, I mean, in that case, if it's Exum and PJ and Derek Jones Jr., if you do have to match up with the Clippers' big three, you have good options to guard all of them. So I feel like Dallas has the personnel to guard the Clippers. They've been the better defense as of late. I feel like they have the more unstoppable offensive formula with their two stars. I mean, a top three player on the planet and a guy who has been playing like a top 15 player in Kyrie. That's just so dependable. And I have more questions about the Clippers. James Harden, big old question mark. Is Kawhi Leonard healthy? Because healthy Kawhi in the playoffs is a bona fide, damn near unstoppable superstar. Since 2020, or since 2019, he's 30 points per game on 63% true shooting in the playoffs. He could be the best player on the floor. All due respect to Luka, Kawhi is that great, especially when you consider his defensive impact. He could still be the best player on the floor. But we just don't know if he's going to be healthy. This is a concerning time for him to be dealing with injury. And I've said this a few times now, but last year, you get Kawhi for two games against the Suns. He's kicking everybody's ass. He's outplaying KD. He's outplaying Book. All you get is two games. Bye-bye Clippers playoff chances. So the Mavs have been humming, man. If you take out these last two games where they haven't played anybody, they're 21-7 since the Gafford and PJ Washington trades. They're fourth in offensive rating, sixth in defensive rating. They've been so much better as a rebounding team, so much more athletically capable in the front court. To me, they're still the second best team out West. So even though I think the Clippers are really talented, and if they dial in and Harden doesn't shit himself, this should be a hell of a series. I'm going to take the Mavs in six.
I'm also going to take the Mavs in six, and I think James Harden is the X factor. Like, he is just the ceiling raiser for this team. If he is hitting open threes, if he is hitting his pull-up threes, if he is setting up his teammates for success, I think the Clippers can win this series. I just don't have that faith in them. And I do think, I said Bones Highland, there's three other guys. I mean, if Harden isn't hitting, put Norman Powell out there. Put Terrence Mann out there. Put Russell Westbrook. Try something else. But, you know, again, you're killing your depth advantage. Like, that to me is the key. I think James Harden has to pull his weight and has to do his thing. He hasn't shown me ever on the playoff stage that he could do that, especially not this version of James Harden that we have seen.
We've also never seen him with so little responsibility, though. We haven't seen him as a third option.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Like I said, shooting's a rhythm thing, and if his jumper hasn't been hitting for the past 20 games, I'm not going to expect just the, you know, the switch to flip. And I'm not saying he can't have a great game. I mean, damn, man, Harden had, what, 250 pieces in last year's playoffs?
240 pieces, yeah.
240 pieces. I'm not saying he can't get hot for a game, man, but consistently, he's been a letdown. And, yeah, so for that reason, I'm going to take Dallas. I think Dallas has been the hotter team, the better team, and I think they're better on both sides of the floor. So, and I think they got the best player on the floor, man. I think Luka's going to ball out. So I'm also taking Dallas in six.
I don't think it's out of the question that there are stretches where Harden is just shooting you out of a game or he's just a non-factor, and then it's like, all right, let's get some more value somewhere. And Russ is probably the most intriguing there just because when you have like high motor Russ, who we saw against the Suns last year, was playing as hard as I've ever seen him, doing the little things, defending. Like, people always talk about, oh, Russ always plays hard. And I think there is generally a conflation between this guy is super athletic, so he kind of has to be going with the ball in his hands, pushing the tempo. Like, it looks like that guy is quote-unquote playing hard, but if you're not moving without the ball, if you're not defending hard, then you're not actually playing hard. And that's been the case for Russ for a vast majority of his career. But last year in the playoffs, we got a Russ who was playing hard. And just because of his athleticism, his ability to pressure the rim and playmake, like, I can definitely imagine that there's a game where you'd rather close with him than Harden. I'm not optimistic about Harden. I am not optimistic. He has been bad. I am just not going to write him off as convincingly as you are and say, he's a non-factor. He's going to suck. There's going to be volatility there. When the pull-up jumper's falling, though, it's like he's a good offensive player.
Yeah, and when it's not, he's shooting pull-up jumpers early in the shot clock, long rebounds, kind of shooting yourself in the foot. And the one thing about Russ, too, man, Russ is a confidence guy. Russ is one of the most rhythm and confidence guys maybe ever. Like, you could see it in his play in L.A., right, where it was just, he just crumbled.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
What's up? I'm John Wall.
And I'm CJ Toledano, and we're starting a new podcast presented by DraftKings called Point Game. We're now joined by three-time NBA Sixth Man of the Year, elite bucket getter. Let's please welcome Jamal Crawford to Point Game, King of the Court one-on-one tournament. If they had it back in your prime, do you think you could have took it all?
I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think I could have took it all, but I think I would have shocked a lot of people. I think Kobe and everybody in their prime, Kobe would win a one-on-one contest.
Yeah, because you got to think, he's going to guard. He don't care about guarding.
He's going to guard.
He's going to guard. Like, you see him in the Olympics, he's going to guard. And then on top of that.
Like that, see that?
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Sam Cassell to Point Game.
I remember you came to my room crying tears. Crying tears. I mean, he was in a culture shock. He's going to withdraw us about winning.
Remember what I told you? I said, OG, you think I can get paid and go back and play in college because it ain't it?
Check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, DraftKings YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Jeff T from the Club 520 podcast. You'll know when you get it. It'll say eBay, authenticity, guarantee. You'll feel it because when it comes to your feet, eBay has your back. Maybe it's that head-turning pair for hooping or a hot new collab. Whatever you're after, when you cop on eBay, you can trust that your kicks will be checked by experts, not just any expert. Sneaker experts who live and breathe the culture. Real people with real hands-on authentication experience. That's when blue checkmark represents on our listing. eBay authenticity guarantee, meaning every inch, stitch, sole, logo is verified authentic through a detailed inspection. So when you finally step into those grill kicks, you'll realize the feeling is unlike any other. And with eBay authenticity guarantee, the feeling of real is always within reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Shell of himself. Washington, in a rhythm, in a flow, the leader of the team, playing good ball. He's got a well-defined role here. I think he believes in himself. I think he's confident. And I think he's been in rhythm. If Harden is shitting his pants, I would turn to Russ. I mean, the options aren't great, but I would turn to Russ.
Yeah. I like how it's such a real possibility, almost a given, that James Harden is going to shit his pants. That's the verbiage that we've both used. So it's Mavs in six, accordingly. The other series we're going to talk about today, Logan, is the 4-5 out east. Cavs Magic. The Cavs, with a little bit of Game 82 tanking to get their way into the 4 seed. And some are wondering if the basketball gods will punish them. We talked about this earlier with the Lakers. I don't know. We'll have to see. What's the first key to you in this series, Logan?
The first key to me is, can Cleveland pick themselves up off the mat? I mean, dude, we're getting into the later rounds of a title fight here, man, and they're slumped on the ground, man. We're about to get to the 10 count. Cleveland has been the worst playoff team post-All-Star break, a 12-17 record. Hoop Venue, a friend of the show, did a show with us a week back, tweeted that out, does great stuff. You guys should follow him, Hoop Venue_ on Twitter.
Shout out! Big ups!
Yeah, shout out. It's not just the team, it's also their stars. Donovan Mitchell over the last 15, 23-6 on 40-33-89 splits, clearly still hampered. Darius Garland over his last 15, 16-3-7 on 41-33-80 splits. Something we spoke about with Hoop Venue on that show was how Cleveland staggers their minutes come playoff time. Because if you remember during the red-hot stretch of the season, they were without a lot of their key star guys. No Mobley, no Garland. And it was basically the Donovan Mitchell and Jared Allen show with shooters. And it worked. I mean, they cooked, man. They were lighting it up offensively. They were clamps defensively. It was the best stretch of their season. Last season, when we saw all four of their stars healthy in the playoffs, they had an offensive rating of 101.9. It was dead last in all of the playoff field, 16 out of 16. Just a ton of lineup redundancy, a complete lack of spacing, and their offense turned to Donovan Mitchell basically just saying, hey, I'm just going to dribble for about 8 seconds, and then I'm going to take a sidestep three. I'm either going to hit it or I'm not, and if I hit it, all right, cool. If we don't, we better get back on defense. It was a really stagnant, ugly offense, and you could just tell, like, it was frustration. It was, you know, it was palpable for Cleveland. And so I think that they need to stagger their guys' minutes. I think they need to play Strus, LeVert, Merrill heavy minutes. Just give them shooting on the wings. And you got to survive with it, man. You got to hope those guys are hitting their shots. So there's three big keys for me. It's one, how do the stars play? What do Mitchell and Garland look like? It's two, how do they, you know, stagger their lineup? Do we get these staggered rotations where we get two sets of stars, or are you closing with all four of them on the court? And then my final key, and this is something that we saw in the Knicks series that really bit Cleveland in the ass, that really surprised me that they didn't address at all during the regular season. Can they survive with just two real centers in their rotation? There is such a massive burden on Evan Mobley and Jared Allen's shoulders to anchor the interior of this defense, which is also why I think maybe they should stagger their rotation. There's not really a third big guy in this rotation. Do you put Dean Wade at the five? You know, are you running Damian Jones minutes? They basically
were not running Damian Jones minutes.
Yeah, dude. I mean, you're playing 40 minutes of Allen and Mobley. Like, they just were tired. You know, the Knicks just had more guys to turn to. And I wonder, against a big physical athletic team with, you know, with the Wagners, with Wendell Carter Jr., with Paolo Banchero, with, you know, I don't know, you could throw in Goga Batadze off the bench. They just got big guys that are going to be fresh. I wonder if Mobley and Allen are going to be fresh at the end of this series. They were just dogged and tired, man, and they don't have a whole lot of five depth. So I worry about them. Those are just the big – that's the big key for me, man. What the hell does Cleveland look like, and can they correct course? They have by far looked like the worst playoff team in the field post-All-Star break. And they just got to pick themselves up off the mat, man. And I really worry if Donovan Mitchell and Darius Garland aren't at 100%, I mean, can they even generate a 100 offensive rating? Like, how ugly and how bad does their offense look if those guys aren't, you know, at the peak of their powers?
And this is a tough defense to go up against, man. Orlando's been as good defensively as anybody not named Minnesota this whole year. And you're right. Nobody in the playoff field has been worse than the Cavs post-All-Star game. They've been a disaster. But a vast majority of that has been without Donovan Mitchell. And Donovan Mitchell really hadn't looked anything like himself until these last couple games. He had missed 15 of the previous 21, I believe, with that knee injury. The six he had played in, he was giving you 14 points per game on 47% true shooting. But these last two games, to me, have been encouraging. His pull-up jumper has been falling, which has been one thing, but also just like, he's looked twitchy, he's looked quick, he's looked comfortable, he's been assertive. It's like, okay, this is a Donovan Mitchell who I can buy into going in the playoffs, whereas based on what we had seen up to that point, I was like, I don't know, man. I still can't confidently say that he's at 100%, but he looks like a star, at least, whereas previously it was like, this guy shouldn't really be on the court right now. And when he plays, the Cavs are 36-19. They have been a damn good basketball team. That's like, what, a 54-win pace? And this series, to me, is just going to be about who the hell can create consistent shots. Because we are in for a dogfight, bro. We are in for a rock fight. We are in for a throwback. Like Cavs Knicks last year, right? This is a series where you're going to produce some offensive ratings in the low 100s. And this is the one guy who is of the caliber where I think he can consistently get you good shots. He can create penetration. He's a good playmaker and has had a career season there. Also, just as a sidebar, one of the 10 sexiest passers in the league. Like, if I was ranking my sexiest passers, bro, obviously you have to have Jokic and Luka and LeBron and Trey, but Donovan Mitchell is pretty far up there, dude. Just like the one-handed live dribble passes that he whips at 50 miles an hour. He threw a pocket pass with such beautiful spin on it, fired a behind-the-back pass on the money to a shooter like two possessions later. He's just a sexy passer, man. He may not be the best, but he's one of the sexiest, and I believe in him. And I believe in him as by far the best offensive player in the series. Garland also at this point, it's like, can kind of only be better than he has been. Like, I don't think Darius Garland can be any worse. And I do think their willingness to tinker with lineups is a key. You hit on a great point, and it's something that Tyler from Hoop Venue brought up when we had him on. The Cavs net rating this year with their big four, Mitchell, Garland, Mobley, Allen, is just +2. Like, it's really not very impressive because you're just not getting the most diverse skill sets. And so I do think you need to be willing to at times close with like Mitchell, Okoro, Strus, if he's healthy, Dean Wade. Hopefully he's healthy, because I think Dean Wade kind of actually matters. Like, he's just a good rotation player. And Jared Allen. And then you're super switchable. You have reliable shooting, and you have the one lethal on-ball creator and the one elite rim protecting big. That's how the Cavs have looked their best this year. They're still the more talented team, and they still have like the more proven formula. So they should win this series, but they have looked really bad as of late. And on the flip side, Orlando has an emerging weapon who has become more and more available and more of a factor in Jonathan Isaac. And if he can play 30 minutes a game in this series, which, I mean, he's been knocking on the door these last couple games, the Magic are a plus 12 net rating team when he plays. They outscore opposing teams by 12 points per 100 possessions. That's equivalent to being the best team in the league. They have a defensive rating of 105.6 with him out there. That would comfortably be the best in the league. He gives you over 10 rebounds and 4.5 stocks per 36 and just blows games up, man, with his secondary rim protection. He is massive. He is a freak athlete. He is long as hell. He is a problem on switches. So he presents a defensive ceiling that this team's raw defensive rating doesn't even reflect, because if he's out there consistently, like, he's their best defender. All due respect to all defense, Jalen Suggs. He is a different kind of game breaker.
100%, dude. I wrote down that exact same stat, courtesy of cleaning the glass. Jonathan Isaac is a huge X factor to me. And that's why I say, you know, if we don't get Mitchell or Garland at the peak of their powers, I think one, just again, like you said, dude, Orlando is such a dogged defense where I think they can turn this into a nasty, disgusting game, and then a nasty, disgusting series. And then I think that Orlando has, I think I like their depth more in terms of offensive creation. I think they've got more guys, maybe not high-end like Mitchell or Garland, but I think they got more guys who can generate and find their shot. If it's Paolo, if it's Franz, if it's Mo Wagner, you know, if it's Wendell Carter, like, I just think they have more offensively skilled guys that they're going to play. It's an interesting series because earlier in the year when Cleveland was clicking a little more, it's kind of staggering, Carson. This courtesy of NBA.com, they outscored Orlando by nearly 15 points per game just on threes in the regular season. I mean, that's a huge difference. And you talk about reliably generating offense. I may like Orlando's crop of stars. They didn't show it. In the regular season matchups, Orlando shot an effective field goal percentage under 50% on shots outside of the paint. That's 28th in the league. I mean, it was just ugly. So, I mean, dude, we are in for the rock fight of all rock fights in this series, and I'm all for it. I know a lot of people don't like defensive, nasty, grimy games. I'm all for it, man. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's just such a, it's such an unpredictable series. You know what I mean? It's, there's so many different variables that come into play here. And I lean on the team that has more size, that has more athleticism, and that has the higher defensive ceiling, in my opinion. And so, man, if we get, if Donovan Mitchell plays like Donovan Mitchell, I would take Cleveland. But I just don't know if I can anticipate that. And so I think I'm going to lean, I think I'm going to take Orlando in seven.
Wow. Here's why I disagree. I have so many concerns about Orlando's offense. Number one, is Paolo ready to be a legit number one in a playoff series and do so in an offensive situation that is not ideal against still one of the best defenses in the field? Like, he has been one of the least efficient volume scorers in basketball this year, under 55% true shooting. I made a whole video about the good and the bad with him just a few weeks back, but shot selection is still a major issue, and spacing is a factor in that. But at the end of the day, he just takes too many tough mid-range pull-up jumpers. He settles too much, and he's not good at those shots. He's 39% inside the paint, outside the restricted area. He's 40% for mid-range. He has a tendency to turn his back to the basket on drives. He has a tendency to settle for these tough turnarounds when he has physical advantages. There was a game just last week, I forget who they were playing, but he had some guard switched onto him. I was watching with my friend, and I said, he's going to shoot a tough turnaround here. And sure enough, that's what he did. Like, he has just not optimized his efficiency, and he has not matured to the basketball player that he's capable of being. Of course he hasn't, because he's in this second year. But people see Paolo, and they go, oh my God, look at these traits. ooh, he's got a little bit of a LeBron movement style to him, and his playmaking is so advanced for his age, and he has these moments of tough shot making, and they want to say, like, he is the guy right now who we are projecting him to be, but he's still a young guy, super inefficient, super inconsistent as a shot maker, and the Cavs are really, really well built to guard him. He had one awesome game against them where he was getting a step, and he was also just like putting on a show in terms of difficult shot making, but he mostly struggled across the other three matchups. And I think that they have a number of good options to guard him. Jared Allen, to me, is a really good primary option. In the first matchup, Paolo was beating him a little bit with foot speed, but then from that point forward, Allen just started kind of playing further off him. And Paolo's really not that quick in the half court in terms of just first step. Where he wins as a driver more often is with his physicality. And Allen guards well in space for a big, and you are not going through him. Like, he is super, super strong. And then outside of him, Mobley still brings great size and length, and Paolo's tendency is just to settle, and so Mobley affects those shots. Dean Wade, if he's healthy, has the exact kind of build, right? A strong, big wing, moves well in space. Okoro, a little bit shorter, but athletic, low center of gravity, defensive dog. Even Niang and Struess, you would never want to, like, be the matchup for Paolo. But off a switch, like, those guys are stout. They're not easily moved off their spots, and that's kind of what Paolo has to do to be most effective. So I think it's a tough matchup for a guy who hasn't proven that he's at the place where it's like, yeah, that guy can be your number one in a playoff series and you can win it. And then you look to Franz, and it's like, can he step up? Can he be your best offensive player? And it's possible, but first of all, we know Paolo is going to have the keys in terms of usage. He's just going to be the highest priority. And Franz's shot just hasn't fallen all year. He's been, like, consistently around 28% from deep. And the Cavs are really well built to guard him too. Like, for a team that is lacking in perimeter shooting, that is going to try to create penetration and do so with, like, two big wings who are not necessarily the quickest, this team with a collection of versatile bigs and big wings, stout wings, it's just like they're built in a lab to guard the Magic. And I think Okoro is probably going to be the primary matchup for Franz. That's tough to me. And outside of that, I just don't think they have enough shot making. Like, scoring in the paint is going to be tough against the Cavs, and they are going to play those gaps aggressively on Paolo and Franz drives and make their lives hard. And they're going to force you to beat them with your spot up shooting. And I just don't think Orlando is proven enough there. And really, the only defensive weakness for Cleveland is at the point of attack with their small guards. And can any Magic guard produce enough offense for that to matter? Who? Cole Anthony?
Well, I mean, I think Anthony and Fultz provide an interesting challenge just in terms of, I think they can, you know, I think they can get the defense in rotation a little bit. I do think shooting variance is a big swing factor in this series. And there is a chance where if Orlando falls asleep enough during a game and concedes enough shots that Cleveland could just outshoot them from behind the arc. But here's my thing. I think if Cleveland gets this thing done early, four or five games, I think it favors them, like, where if they're red hot shooting. But if this series goes long, I just think Allen and Mobley are going to be worn out at the end of this series, man. I know there's more time between games because it's the first round. I'm just really concerned about them holding up over a long series trying to play 40 minutes a night versus Orlando bigs that are just going to be fresher. And I am leaning more on, I would lean more on Fultz. I'd lean more on Anthony. And I'd lean on those guys trying to
playing Markelle Fultz in this series, man. Shit is going to get clogged up if you're playing Markelle Fultz in this series.
I'm just talking about in terms of those guys trying to create penetration at the point of attack against Garland and Mitchell. Those would be the guys that I'm attacking defensively. And Struess, like, I don't know, man. I'm just wondering, like, do you really think there's that big of a gap between Cleveland and Orlando's offense?
Absolutely. When Donovan Mitchell is himself, absolutely, dude. I think you're underselling, like, how uniquely bad a playoff offense Orlando is. They're 22nd in offensive rating. Only two teams in the last decade have won a playoff series ranking that low.
I'm not underselling that. I just think that Orlando also really matches up well against Cleveland's offense. Like, Suggs at the point of attack.
I think
all
both
of
teams
those
are
big
built to guard each other well, for sure. But then give me by far the best shot creator and shot maker on the floor in Donovan Mitchell. Darius Garland has had a down year, but he absolutely could be the second best offensive player in this series. Cleveland does have more perimeter shooting, period, point blank. Orlando's last in threes made. They're toward the bottom in three-point percentage. And again, I worry about Fultz being the guy who you're like, okay, he's going to create our advantages, because then you have Paolo and Franz, who have really struggled to spot up shooters off ball, or you have those guys with the ball in their hands and Fultz, who is a terrible spot up shooter off ball alongside them. Suggs just isn't going to take that initiative as a creator, and you need him out on the floor for his spot up shooting and his point of attack defense. I just don't think this Orlando team is there yet. Like, Cleveland has been playing bad basketball, but the ceiling they have shown is in a different stratosphere. And there is a threshold at which it's like, okay, you're so good defensively and you're good enough offensively where I think you can grind these series out. Orlando's not there. And it's not because Cleveland's offense is super pretty. It's not because they're one of the better playoff offenses in this field at all. But they certainly have higher highs there and they have more talent at the end of the day. And that's just what I'm going to bet on. I worry about Orlando just having ugly, ugly games offensively.
I think this whole series is going to be really ugly, man. I'm going to take the bigger, more physical team, and I just think Orlando has more quality basketball players that I like, man. I'm going to take Orlando in seven.
Cleveland's pretty big, man. Cleveland's pretty freaking big, too. I'm going to take the Cavs in six. I think these are both elite defenses, but ultimately, in these ugly, grinded out environments, you got to have that guy who can just get his shot in a series like this. And Paolo, I just don't think is at that level yet. I think he's going to take a lot of tough shots. I think he's going to miss a lot of tough shots. I think he's going to make a lot of good decisions as a passer, but I'm not sure that Orlando has the shooting necessary to like consistently hold Cleveland accountable. And he still takes too many tough shots. So we will disagree on that one. We agree on Mavs Clippers. Any final thoughts before we get out of here?
I'm just really excited for Cavs Magic. I think it's going to be like such a uniquely grimy series. I think it's just going to be a lot of fun.
Oh, it's going to be grimy. It's going to be dirty. And you're going to like it, pal. That's exactly your speed. But before that, we do have the play-in. So we will be back Wednesday morning. We'll react to what we see Tuesday night in the Western Conference play-in. And then we will preview a couple more full playoff series. If you enjoyed this show, as always, there is more Nerd Sesh content on our YouTube channel, our full shows. We'll do breakout clips with all these series previews. We have our video essays where we go super in-depth on specific topics. You can follow us across social, TikTok, Instagram, at NerdSesh, Twitter, at Nerd_Sesh. If you want to see clips from the show and if you want to stay dialed into all of our trivia content, you can, of course, listen to the podcast across all audio platforms. And if you want the hat that Logan is wearing, that very hat right off of his head, you can buy that at thevolume.com. And you can join our Discord at the link at our link tree across our social media bios. Matt Sponauer is in there. And Logan, some final words. We have been issued a challenge by the Stay Hot podcast. Three silly little boys speaking into their microphones, thinking they can say whatever they want and get away with it. They said they'd make a better musical than us. And just know that story is not over. That's all I'll say at this time. That story is not over. So, with that, as always, appreciate you guys. I have been Carson Brabber.
I have been Logan Camden.
And this was Nerd Sesh.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Getting ready to take on spring? Make your first move with the reliable performance and power of Steel battery tools. From hedge trimmers and mowers to string trimmers and more, right now you can save $50 on select battery tool sets. Real Steel. Offer valid on select AK system sets through June 16, 2024. See participating retailer for details.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cb for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.